This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Today is November 28, 2005. Today's interview is with Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio, film historian, Emeritus Professor of Communication Arts, also Emeritus First Director of the University's Arts Institute. Tino, to start the interview, perhaps you could tell us when you were born, where you were born, and a little bit about your childhood.
Yes, I was born on November 12, 1937, in Albion, Michigan, which was where my grandparents ended up after having immigrated from Sicily. My grandfather had a job working in a steel mill in Albion, Michigan, which, by the way, is a small college town located in south-central Michigan. My family moved to Harvey, Illinois, and then we moved to Hammond, Indiana by the time I was in first grade. And I spent all of my youth and adolescence in Hammond, Indiana, going to St. Joseph's grade school and then to Hammond High. I graduated from Hammond High in 1955.
Tino, let me ask you if along the way there were any significant teachers, either in elementary school or in high school.
Yes, I had a, as the name of the grade school suggested, was a Catholic grade school. I was brought up in a rather conservative Catholic Italian family. And I didn't really prosper in Catholic schools. As a matter of fact, after graduating from St. Joseph's grade school, I went to Bishop Knoll High School for 1 year. And then I transferred to Hammond High for my sophomore, junior, and senior years. It was at this public high school that I began to flourish as a person and as an academic. I had serious misgivings about some of the elements of Catholicism as they were taught to us in grade school, even though I wasn't a very sophisticated person, but I had reservations about the way things were going, and in particular, I disliked the militaristic administration at Bishop Knoll High School.
Was that, I assume that was a boys' school?
No, it wasn't. It was a co-ed school. This was, of course, in the 1950s when Roman Catholicism was at its strongest point in the United States. And I'll give you a couple of examples of things that bothered me at Bishop Knoll High School. There was an intercom system, of course, that allowed the principal, who was a priest, to communicate with the entire high school. And typically after lunch every day, there would be high school announcements. And I remember one Friday afternoon, right after lunch, he interrupted classes to state that he had heard that some Bishop Knoll students were eating hamburgers at a local drive-in restaurant on a Friday. And of course, back then, you could not eat meat on Friday. And he ranted and raved for a long time. And even then, when I was 13 or 14, I thought this was rather bizarre for him to go on like this. And I thought something was amiss here. More than that, I was failing as a student. I was doing okay in English literature, which I enjoyed, but I was very slow in developing my mathematical skills. I took a course in algebra my freshman year, and Sister Agneta, I'll never forget her, ranked students according to their performance in class. This was like a medieval concept of creating a hierarchy. The smartest student was the best performing student in algebra, was in the first row of the first seat. And the least accomplished student in algebra was in the last row in the last seat, which is where I sat for much of the semester.
Are you serious?
I'm perfectly serious. I was totally humiliated by this, and I think that the humiliation of this hierarchical arrangement inhibited me from learning algebra as best I could at the time. Well, I felt that I wasn't prospering in this type of environment. So against my parents' better wishes, I transferred to a public high school. And there I did prosper.
I take it now your parents did not stand in your way.
No, they did not, no. I should tell you a little bit about my parents, my upbringing, to place all this in some sort of perspective. My father sold fruits and vegetables. This was the era before the supermarket, when milkmen, fruit and vegetable salesmen, cleaners would have regular customers they would visit throughout the week. My father sold high-quality fruits and vegetables from a truck to regular customers throughout the week.
Uh-huh.
And this was the period when most housewives were at home all day,
uh-huh.
and this was a convenience that they enjoyed. But of course, this would be a dying business in the 50s when supermarkets came into existence.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, my father worked very hard throughout his life, and we led a middle-class existence. When we moved to Hammond, by the time I was in grade school, we moved to a new subdivision, which was pleasant. Certainly wasn't luxurious, but it was new in an improved part of Hammond. And we were there living with other middle-class families. And we had a nice house. But my father was a stern taskmaster. He was the kind of person who hated to see me standing still. He always thought that he should be putting me to work. So from a very early age, I worked all the time. I'll give you an example. From the time I was 8 years old, in the summertime, I would go house to house with a wagon, and I would sell whatever fruits or vegetables were in season at the time.
Huh.
And like, for example, when strawberries were in season, I would have a wagon full of quart boxes of strawberries, and I would go out in the morning, and I couldn't come back until all of them were sold, which was okay. Strawberries are good sellers. But my father, in his own way, did things to make my life difficult. Because sometimes, in addition to giving me strawberries to sell, he would put in some stalks of celery, like pastoral celery. Well, there's very little demand for celery. So you would have to, you know, find somebody who would be willing either to buy strawberries and celery, or celery by itself. Anyway, it complicated life, and I was wondering as a kid, why is he complicating my life like this? But this is the kind of person he was. He did this, I think, for two reasons. First of all, he wanted to train me to survive in life, and secondly, to help him out to a certain extent. Well, throughout my grade school and high school education, I always had jobs. In the summertime, I did this. When I was a kid, I had paper routes. When I was a little bit older, I worked in grocery stores after school for 2 or 3 hours every night. I worked as a janitor in a bank when I was in high school. Wouldn't come home until 10 o'clock at night for the most part. So essentially, throughout my grade school and high school years, I was self-supporting.
Were you allowed to save that money, Jim?
Okay, that's a good question. I wasn't paid by my father when I worked for him, but of course when I worked at a grocery store, I had a paper route. The money that I used, I gave to my father, who in turn gave me an allowance. But for the most part, I bought my own clothing, which was problematic in some regards, and pretty much I supported my social life throughout high school. I will get into my college years later on, but the point I'm making is that I work all the time, not because I desired to, but because my father thought this was the thing to do. I did not have a pleasant childhood because I did not have any leisure. I was always working, and I always felt that other students or other friends, and I felt this way the older I became, had a lot more opportunities to develop socially and culturally. I never had time because I was always working.
Did you have siblings?
I have a sister who is 5 years younger than I am. Uh-huh. She was young enough for me not to really remember a whole lot of growing up with her because of this age difference. Mm-hmm. But we always got along well. This being a conservative Italian Catholic family, my father's attitude towards my sister was somewhat different. You must understand that my father did this because he himself led a rather impoverished life and a hard life when he was growing up, because he had to endure a lot of hard work and deprivation because my grandparents were illiterate. They did not have a great deal of money. They had lots of children and everybody had to work. So the overlay that I received was, in a sense, an extension of his upbringing. This was not an invention of his own, but an overlay of his experience growing up the son of immigrants.
And talk a little bit about your mother.
Yes, the two sides of my family were like night and day. My father's parents were stern, very religious, darkly religious, strongly Catholic, somewhat superstitious, and they, in a sense, denied themselves most of the material pleasures in life, which doesn't mean to say that they were impoverished, but that's just the way they lived. My mother's parents, on the other hand, were quite different. They were, of course, Catholic, but not as deeply religious and observant as my father's parents. My mother's family loved to have nice homes. Their homes were always well appointed with nice furniture. I remember that they enjoyed cooking. They had parties. They were much more sociable. All done, within a family situation. They were the flip side, you might say, of the Italian life that my father's parents lived in Hammond. And I always enjoyed going to Albion, Michigan to visit my grandparents because of their lifestyle, how different it was from my father's side.
Were they Italian Catholics too?
Of course, yes. They all came from Sicily. All my grandparents came from Sicily at one point or another, yes. But they were certainly quite different. They enjoyed life. They had a different attitude towards it, and this was one of the more positive experiences I had growing up, young Catholic boy in suburban Hammond, Indiana.
You must take after your mother's side of the family. You are engaging and charming.
Well, thank you. But I think my father did instill a sense of the work ethic. If he instilled anything in me, he did that. I was never afraid of hard work afterwards.
But. Well, you look at your resume, Tino, and the number of books and articles borders on phenomenal. I mean, you've been very productive as a scholar.
Well, thank you.
I think that's obvious. So, you're in high school, and you mentioned that even at age 13 and 14 at Bishop Knoll High School, you were interested in literature.
Yeah, I guess I knew that I wanted to learn. There was something in me that I can't explain that propelled me, that made me discriminate against bad teaching and made me, I guess I stated another way, I think that I knew who I was at a very early age. That I knew that I wanted to get an education, I knew that I wanted to excel, I knew that I wanted to differentiate myself from most other people to become, a learned person in some way or another, although I probably would never have characterized it that way. But I was hungry for an education. Maybe it was because I was deprived culturally growing up that I was so interested in learning and acquiring knowledge. I remember, for example, when I was in early high school, my parents bought a portable phonograph. And this was, of course, the era before hi-fis and stereos. Uh-huh. Okay, but nonetheless, the reason for this, of course, is my mother wanted play some popular music and so forth. But I just sort of globbed onto that machine and started buying classical music. And eventually just sort of took it over and began to expose myself to classical music. And I remember the first time I listened to the Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, just like I remember the first time I read Hamlet. These are important moments in my life when I experienced these things. But there was a hunger there that I didn't understand the source of, but it was certainly there, and it propelled me. I knew that I wanted to, learn more and get a fine education as best I could.
Tino, were there other scholars in your family?
I was the first person to go to college in our family. No, for the most part, not almost exclusively, this is a working class family.
Uh-huh.
My uncles were also in the fruit and vegetable business, or this is lower middle class, but it's hard to make these distinctions, but clearly I was the first student to go into college.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
This hunger for knowledge or interest in learning was just there, it was part of
it. Yes, it was. But I was, it took me a while to catch up because I had, there was a lot of catching up to do. And it took me 2 or 3 years in high school for me to acquire more skills and to perform at an acceptable level, or good level.
I see that many of your degrees are in English literature. Were you reading and writing in a scholarly way in high school?
No, my writing, this is one of the things I had to catch up with, my writing, because I was never taught writing very well. As a matter of fact, I did not know how to write well until I got into graduate school, I think, where I really felt like I was competent as a writer. When I was thinking about going to college, I never thought of going into English literature. The rationale back then for me to go to college was to become a doctor. And that was because becoming a doctor would be a practical rationale for going to college. I can't imagine if I told my father that I wanted to go to college to become an English major, that this would have been a very convincing case. Mm-hmm. But because I said that I wanted to be, and I guess I did, but I didn't know what that really meant. When it came time to consider going to college, this was my my rationale. But of course, things change once you get to college.
Tino, before we leave high school, are there any significant intellectual influences of any of your high school teachers?
Yes, there was a high school teacher, several as a matter of fact, who influenced me greatly. I used to sing, in grade school and in high school. In grade school, I was a member of the church choir. We sang for Mass every day. Then when I went to high school, I joined chorus. And there were several degrees of singing at Hammond High, beginning with a chorus for freshmen and sophomores, then another group for juniors, and then there was a group for the seniors. And I went through all three of those and enjoyed singing very much. We sang classical music for the most part. And the teacher, Miss Waterbury, talked to us about classical musicians, classical music, and so forth. And that was a very enjoyable experience in my life. This was my first and only exposure to music as a performer. When I was in grade school, the school conducted, you might say, some sort of a talent search. This was sponsored by a local musical instrument company. And they gave all of us in class a test to see if we were musically inclined. And I was identified as a person who was musically inclined. And then the payoff was that our parents were invited to a meeting one evening where the local music store displayed an array of musical instruments. And the deal was for us individuals who were so identified to choose an instrument that we might wish to play. And I didn't know one musical instrument from another at the time, and I just pointed at a saxophone, which happened to be very expensive, and I think that turned off my father, and nothing more was done about my musical education, which I really regret. Although they did buy an upright piano for my sister, and I played that on my own, but never received musical instruction from it. But anyway, in high school, I did sing in all these choirs and enjoyed the experience very much. And this one teacher I thought was a very fine person who instilled the sensibility of music in me that I haven't experienced since. There was an English teacher there, and there always is an English teacher, who was Mr. Muir, who rode a motorcycle. And he wore leather jackets and everything. He was sort of an example of the counterculture in the 1950s. But he was a very cultured guy himself, and even though he had this dress about him and everything, he was a guy who taught us speed reading during our lunch hours and talked to us as people about literature, about pop culture. How much he disliked the lyrics of popular songs at the time, and how much that we enjoyed other things. But he was an unusual person. Also, I had relations with teachers at Hammond High who related to me on a personal level. For example, Miss Waterbury was going out with another high school teacher in school, and I forget his name, unfortunately, but he was talking to me one time about how difficult it was for them to go out in public together. Because if students would see them, you know, they would start yakking or snickering or some such thing. But I thought that was rather nice of him to relate to me as an adult about something that was rather personal.
Indeed.
So in other words, I really enjoyed him in high school. It was a fine high school. Most of the students went on to college. I don't know if all, I mean, I don't know which percentage, but this was a high school that had many fine students and excellent teaching for the most part. And in Hammond, this was, of course, you know, in the 50s and early 60s, this was a golden era for an industrial part of the world. I mean, Hammond, East Chicago, Whiting, Gary, were very prosperous during this time. This was the era of big steel.
And the steel mills were doing well.
Well, yes, right. And this was a period when the steel mills were providing fine employment for blue-collar workers, recent immigrants, college students. It was a very prosperous part of Indiana, or suburban Chicago, if you will, depending upon which way you wish to look at it. So this was before a major economic and social crash that took place in the 70s when big steel went down the tube, so to speak. But it was a fine place to grow up at the time, I thought. Also, it was fine to grow up because of its proximity to Chicago. You could drive into Chicago half an hour, 45 minutes at most, and it was totally safe. You can go to Hyde Park near the University of Chicago and hit some blues bars and hear some marvelous music.
And would you do that?
Of course. We'd go to Grand Park concerts in the summertime, hear classical music, all free. Or you could go to the near north side where some wonderful jazz was always being played. Again, totally safe, and it was just a marvelous experience growing up in that area at that time. And these are things that I did take advantage of growing up as best I could.
Tino, we'll get to this much later, but of course your prominence as a film historian and your work with the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. Are you at this point in your life in high school becoming significantly engaged in film, or you?
No, I was a snob. I listened to classical music. Movies back then, you know, we're talking now in the early 50s, there wasn't an art theater in Madison, I mean in Hammond, and there were just regular commercial theaters, and the movies did not take on any sort of special aura as an art form, at least not for me at that time.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't until I was a senior in college that I was first exposed to a significant art film, and that was Fellini's La Strada, which our college just happened to show one weekend, and that awakened me to a different kind of film that I had been unaccustomed to experiencing before then.
So much of your cultural experience in high school seems to be focused on music. Actually.
Music and reading, yes, right. So, towards the end of high school, I started reading, you know, George Orwell and Aldous Huxley and, you know, all of the trendy things back then. Yeah, that's right. So
you were pretty clear, I take it, that you knew you were going on to college.
Yes, I wanted to. Yes, right, absolutely. There were college nights at the high school, whereby representatives from different colleges and universities throughout the country would interview prospective students. And there was a representative from Yale whom I met on two occasions, and it seemed like he was interested in having me apply. But you must understand, I was the first person in the family to go on to college, and my parents did not know anything about colleges and universities to speak of. And they were concerned about my welfare, my spiritual welfare. Well, the long and short of it is, a friend of the family, not so much a direct friend of the family, but the president of a local bank, had graduated from Wabash College, knew my father, and told him that Wabash College, which is a men's school, would be a fine place to send me. And this was a convincing argument from my parents' point of view, because by sending me to a men's school, the presumption was that there would be no women around and that my spiritual well-being would be intact. Moreover, this was the period when Kinsey was promulgating his research at Indiana University. So my mother says, you are not going to go to Indiana University because of Dr. Kinsey being there, thinking that he would, you know, have an impact on everybody who lived there. So my father was willing to send me to Wabash College. It was close by, about 100 miles away. It was a men's school, and I would not, you know, leave the geographical area to speak of. So this was the compromise that sent me to college.
Did you linger at all over the possibility of Yale, or did you put
that
aside?
No, I was somewhat apprehensive about it, thinking that I wouldn't survive there academically. I was realistic in knowing that I had a lot of catching up to do.
Uh-huh.
And that I said that probably I wouldn't be the dumbest person there, but I probably wouldn't be the smartest either. So
you graduated from high school when?
In 1955.
And did you go straight into Wabash?
Right.
Did you have friends that went there too? Or?
Yes, there were a couple of, as a matter of fact, Mr. Wilhelm's son was going to Wabash. He was 1 year ahead of me. And a couple of my friends from Hammond High also went to Wabash as well. As it turns out, it's a very fine school now. I mean, it's one of the top rated private liberal arts colleges in the country now as far as teaching is concerned and so forth. But I got a fine education there, and I will be explaining my experiences there. And I could have gone to worse places, believe me.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So you are, as you look back on it, content that you went to Wabash?
Well, it was better than nothing, in the sense that it gave me a fine education, and because I spent my junior year abroad, this opened up all kinds of opportunities for me that I thought would be invaluable, uh-huh, in retrospect, yes.
Okay, but you know, Tino, I think I'm just, we're about to end the tape, so I'm just going to forward it to the next slide.
Yes.
This is side two of tape one of the November 28th, 2005 interview with Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio. Tino, you were about to go to Wabash.
Yes, I should tell you about how my education at Wabash was financed, since I spent a considerable amount of time talking about the fact that my father always put me to work. The year before I went to Wabash, I began working for the Hammond Sanitary District. The Hammond Sanitary District was the place where they processed all of the sewage.
Uh-huh.
Now, my job was to cut the grass. My father knew the superintendent of the Hammond Sanitary District and got me a job there. And I worked the entire summer cutting grass. This was a large expanse of facilities with lots of grass that kept me very busy. Over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, I would return there every summer to cut grass. Starting out, they gave me a rather primitive machine that I basically had to push. And that was a back-breaking experience because this was a hilly place. Over time, they upgraded their lawnmower equipment, which made my job easier. But the point I'm making is that I turned over all of my income to my father, who would give me a weekly salary, I mean a weekly allowance, which I would use, of course, for whatever. But once I enrolled in Wabash, I didn't have to work. My father footed the bill. You must understand, back then, tuition at Wabash was $500. No, it was less than that. It was something like $400 a year.
Wow.
Plus room and board. But I made much of that over the summer. But nonetheless, when I started college, I did not have to take on extra jobs when I was in school.
Uh-huh.
But when I was not in school, of course, I always worked. So this was significant and allowed me to devote my full attention to college work. Wabash College back then was, and still is a men's school. They have fraternities there, and back then they only had a few dormitories. And as a result of this, the fraternity system was rather strong, but it wasn't. There was no social hierarchy involved in that. You were, in a sense, allocated to a fraternity, and there wasn't a heavy-duty rush scene. So I guess it was like a symbiotic relationship. The college needed the fraternities because the college didn't have enough dorms for all of its students. The fraternities needed young men to be a part of fraternity life. So I was apportioned to Phi Gamma Delta when I went to Wabash and lived in that house for the years that I was there.
Huh.
And I started out, this was a rather primitive place at the time, a men's college in Crawfordsville, Indiana, in a small town in the middle of the cornfields, is not the most exciting place to be. But at the same time, the students there were relatively serious in that people studied almost all the time.
Uh-huh.
It was
a tough school.
Yeah, right, absolutely. In order to get a B in the class, you'd have to work very hard. And people got C's, and it was hard work to excel at Wabash. There was no grade inflation by any means. And I started out as a pre-med student. I started out taking a course in German. By the way, I took 3 years of Spanish when I was in high school. I didn't follow up on it, unfortunately, because I thought that one needed study German to go into pre-med, which is, of course, a myth. There's no reason to do so,
uh-huh,
because one did not read medical text in the original German, but everybody said you need to take German if you're going into medicine. So I started out, I did take a couple of years of German, It was not my favorite language, but nonetheless, I did take it. And, you know, biology and English and so forth, the regular courses. And I got basically B's, I think, my first couple of years. I must say, though, that picking up on a previous thread about my years in high school when I started out failing in algebra, I took a course in physics, which required an understanding of calculus, and I got an A.
Here's true.
Yes, right. I thought, because I worked very hard. I'm not sure I ever understood calculus, but I studied hard enough to be able to memorize, you know, things enough to ace exams. And I haven't used calculus since, but that was something that I felt proud of, because I overcame this real handicap, I thought, from grade school. A major turning point in my college career was an opportunity to spend my junior year abroad. The college was just initiating such a program, and they didn't have an office that found a university for you. You were on your own to search for an appropriate place to go if you wish. And as it happened, a friend of mine had done some spade work to find out about this program at the University of Exeter in England, which was designed for overseas students. And the deal was that, the area of specialization would be English literature. Backing up a bit, a major turning point in my academic life occurred when I was a sophomore in college, and I have either the good fortune or the bad fortune to take a course in modern fiction and poetry. Mm. And it was then, when I took this course in modern fiction, reading James Joyce and D.H. Lawrence and others, that I really became interested in literature. Mm-hmm. This was very exciting for me, and I decided then that I was not going to go on into medical school, or to pre-med, I should say, but I was really interested in literature because the books were talking about life, aspects of life that I had never been exposed to or experienced, which I found very exciting. I remember spending lots of time reading T.S. Eliot. I mean, probably more time than you can imagine, trying to figure out just what The Wasteland really meant, among other things.
So who was that professor?
His name was Donald Baker. It was a very, he was not a flamboyant professor. He was low-key, he was droll, somewhat sardonic, and I love that aspect about him. And he let you discover literature on your own, and he encouraged you to say almost anything you wished in class to explore things. Uh-huh. I even began to write some poetry at the time, and one of my poems was published in the college literary magazine, I think even before its inaugural issue. My poem was strongly influenced, by the way, by T.S. Eliot. But I would not wish to reread it at this point, but very, very heady stuff at the time. So,
were your parents aware at this point that you were switching to English?
Yeah. And they didn't bother them. The only thing that bothered my father more than anything else was the thought that by going to college, I was losing my Catholic faith, because I no longer believed in whatever the church told you. Okay. I began to question the church and actually had a lot to say against it. And he attributed that to going to college. He was pissed off at one point. And Tony says, well, had I known that this would happen to you by going to college, I would not have sent you. But, you know, he backed off of that. So I continued with my ways. So you might say that I was becoming a young bohemian. That was the term people used back then.
Uh-huh.
You know.
So this was the late 50s.
Yeah, right. This is when you smoked cigarettes and read poetry and talked about the meaning of life in a very serious tone of voice.
Tino, did you have to apply for the program to go abroad?
Yes, I did, but I think they were more than happy to take whomever.
Oh.
There was no great entrance exam or anything else. The deal was that the college would let me go to Exeter for a year and take a series of courses for which I would get no grade when I returned.
Oh.
But the clincher here is that at Wabash, and then I probably still does, Wabash gave you a comprehensive exam at the end of your 4 years. So, based upon your major area,
uh-huh.
they would grade you, then. So there'd be some accountability at some point, but you just wouldn't get a grade for those courses that you took at Exeter.
So talk a little bit about your year at Exeter.
It was a great year. It was, I had not done any traveling before then to speak of, and I had, as I said, I was pretty much tethered to the home, working all the time, and never had any opportunities to explore life. And going to England, I took a boat. This was the era before jet travel, I took a boat called the Castel Felice from New York to Plymouth, England.
Wow.
A 6-day journey, which was just marvelous. It was not a luxury liner by any means, but it was a one-class boat, a ship, I should say, that had nice accoutrements to it, and it was marvelous. And the best thing about it was that, for me at that time, was once we got into international waters and they opened up the bar, one could buy scotch and water for 10 cents. This was...
Is that true, Tino? For a dime?
For a dime, absolutely, yes, right, absolutely. So, this was marvelous experience for a young man. I was 18 or 19, I guess I was 19 years old then, I guess, going on 20.
Was this mostly a student boat, or were there...
No. A transatlantic travel back then was done a lot by boat.
Mm-hmm.
There was Ile de France, there was the USS United States, so they were plying the waters back and forth. As a matter of fact, they were competing with airlines for transatlantic tourist trade.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the airlines went out. But I came back on the Ile de France, which is a marvelous experience, which I'll talk about later on. But anyway, I went to England. I didn't do much in the way of pre-planning. I never did then, and I don't do now. I just get up and go. And fortunately, my friend was better at organizing things than I was, so at least we had a place to stay once we got there. And he stayed with his family, and then I found another family to stay with for much of the first term, although I did enjoy the experience living with an English family, not because I disliked them as people, but I was a growing boy. I was 6'4" and a prodigious appetite, and I just couldn't get enough food living there. Also, they cramped my social life as well.
Yes.
So, the courses that I took were courses in Victorian novel, English drama, the modern novel, and I think maybe there are four courses that I took throughout the entire year. And this was based upon the English system, whereby you would attend a lecture every week in your course, and then you would have a tutorial with your tutor, and you would write papers and discuss them with him, and there'd be another student with you. So this was the English system of teaching English literature, which I enjoyed enormously. There were students there from not only from the United States, but also from Europe as well. I don't know if there were more than 25 or 30 students involved in the program at the time, but it was a very interesting opportunity to meet students from Europe. And, it was, again, the first time that this occurred. So this is when I really became immersed in English literature. I did some heavy-duty reading in different subjects, and you could pretty much follow your own interest. You didn't have to cover the material on the syllabus, so to speak. Even though they might lecture on the history of the Victorian novel, you could concentrate on whomever, you know, depending upon your interests.
Were you a pretty serious student
there? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But lots of things happened. I was asked to join the basketball team, and I was surprised that Exeter had a basketball team, and I was surprised that basketball was even being played in England. But many universities did have basketball teams. The Brits did not know how to play basketball very well, and hence they were interested in American students playing. Now, I would have never made a team here in the United States, but having grown up in Indiana, I knew how to play basketball, and I was tall, and I had developed a halfway proficient hook shot. Well, the long and short of it was, I was a member of the team, and I became a star, as a matter of fact, and at the end of the year, I was chosen to be a member of the All-England basketball team. Again, it sounds better than it is, but it's all relative, because we're dealing with students who did not really know how to play the game very well. But we would travel all around the country playing basketball. You would go to Southampton, you would go to Manchester, we would go to Wales. On our own, a group of us, maybe eight of us, would take a train, go someplace, play a game, come back. There'd be practically no fans attending these games, unless you brought some with you.
Tino, don't you think that there is perhaps a movie in this story?
Yes, it sounds like, and the deal was, we were all smoking back then, too, and we'd ask the ref, well, ref, how much time do you have for a half time? It's about time enough for a cigarette or something. And then afterwards, we'd all repair to a local pub and drink and go back to Exeter. It was great fun, and enjoyable, and...
Was the team all Americans?
No, there was a mix. There were three Americans, I think, and the rest Brits, yeah. So, much fun, and got to travel around England that way, and that was the first time I ever had that kind of experience of being proficient in a sport, among other things, and I enjoyed that a lot, hugely. But anyway, going back to Exeter, I moved out of this house with this family, and then I moved to a hotel in Exmouth, which is right on the English Channel, about 30 miles away from Exeter. You would get there by train. There was a hotel there that took some of the overflow from the students at Exeter. And a group of us ended up at this Dalforgan Hotel, which served meals there, plenty of potatoes and things like this, and the food. But this was a great experience too, because there was a club. The Dalforgan Hotel had a Dalforgan Club, to which we repaired many nights and drank with the locals and had a great time. I spent a lot of time playing darts that year and became rather proficient playing darts as well as playing basketball.
Tino, I had no idea you were such an athletic stud.
Well, I don't know. If you call playing darts athletic, nonetheless, it was an acquired skill. And if you won, you won beer. I mean, the loser would have to buy a round or something like that. But anyway, that was all part of the social life. It was just marvelous. Also, we got to know people in town. These were young adults more than anything, local businessmen who were part of this club, and that was a great opportunity. Following up on this, towards the end of the year, the last half of the year, a group of us rented a house. And was one of these row houses, you know, you've seen.
Yes.
Yeah, and we rented that and did our own cooking and so forth.
Was that back in Exeter?
Exmouth. Still in Exmouth, yes, right. But great experiences during this time was what happened during our breaks. We had long breaks, semester breaks, over Christmas and then over the spring break, and that provided us with opportunities to travel on the continent.
Oh.
So, again, I wasn't much in the way of interested in pre-planning, and I remember that I just bought one-way ticket from London to Rome, and off I went. I was going to stop off in Milan, because I thought that there was a youth hostel there where I would stay. Well, it turned out there was a youth hostel there, but it was only open in the summertime. So I found a pensione where I stayed a few days, and befriended some guys, and I went to La Scala. And I heard Maria Callas sing.
Oh, you did?
Yes, the Masked Ball. Barrio and Mosquera, yeah, right. Yes, yeah, right. And we tickets were very cheap. We stood during the performance way up there in the wings, not the wings, but up the lofts. And I went to the opera several times while I was there and so forth. Ultimately, I ended up in Rome. And how I rendezvoused with my friends who were coming down by car from Paris, I never know. But you were thoughtless, you just did things and things worked out, and we rendezvoused with them and then drove back to Paris eventually after spending time in Rome and doing things like that. But that was really enjoyable.
Did you go down to Sicily?
No, I didn't. The farthest south I went was to Naples. I went there by myself. For a couple of days, and I went to the opera there, where I saw Norma. I forget who sang it, but I did go that. So you know, I was into high art, so it's like the cheap pensiones and.
Tino, did you understand Italian?
Yeah, a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yes. I understood it more than I could speak it because I grew up in a family that did speak Italian.
Mm-hmm.
But. To be quite honest, I attempted to avoid the language because it wasn't very cool, you might say, back then, to be ethnic. I wanted to distance myself from my ethnic heritage, which was a mistake, of course. But at the time, this is what I wanted to do. But to follow up on my turning my back on my ethnic heritage, I did end up taking Italian. I did so in graduate school. I took a couple of years of Italian language and literature in graduate school. But I learned how to read it, but never learned how to speak it proficiently. So I was able to read some Dante even in Italian, but certainly wasn't able to speak it. And I think that this was a major disappointment in my life. But I've always been very goal-oriented, and I always concentrated on the work at hand. I never left time to pursue other interests, you know, how that goes. But yeah, we're going back to Exeter. I can't begin to tell you how important of a year that was, because traveling in Rome and Paris and just being exposed to sophisticated people and of course, I have to tell you that in Paris, I bought Miller's Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn, smuggled them back into England, you know. I'm sure every college student did this back then, but they were banned, of course, in Great Britain and the United States, but that was all the more incentive to smuggle those books back into the United States, which, of course, I did. But it was a very heady time. This is a period of the young bohemians, the young intellectuals, reading about existentialism, you know, talking about the meaning of life. Very heady experience.
Were you spending much time in London,
too? Yes, we'd go to London on occasions, yes. Did a lot of traveling while I was at Exeter. London, we would go to see plays for the most part.
Are you still in touch with any of your fellow students or faculty from that time, from that year?
Not really. I was invited back to Wabash to give a lecture back in the 1970s after I published one of my books. I was invited back, but of course, the faculty had changed. Mm-hmm. That professor I had alluded to, I mentioned Don Baker, coincidentally retired to Cape Cod. And at the time, my wife's aunt and uncle lived on Cape Cod. And as a matter of fact, they knew him because he was a neighbor. So And there was one summer when we visited Mary's aunt and uncle in Cape Cod, I did maintain contact with Don Baker. He was a very influential person in my life, I think. Mm-hmm. I have another story to tell about Exeter. You had mentioned important professors in my life. There were two instructors teaching this English literature program at Exeter. One professor in particular, his name is Professor Salter, S-A-L-T-E-R, and he was a very eloquent, dramatic lecturer. He was almost a stereotype. He was so good. And I remember, you know, his lectures vividly, and whereas the other instructor was much more terse. He would read his lectures, and they were very eloquent, but they're almost, it's like reading from a scientific text. That's how it came across. But Professor Salter was a very eloquent guy who had a deep voice and a sense of dramatic flair about him. Well, segue now to the late 1980s. I was back in Exeter because at the time a colleague of mine in film was teaching there. And my wife and I were visiting him and his partner, and I wanted to return to Exeter in any event. And I asked him at the time, I says, Richard, is Professor Salter still alive? He says, oh, yeah. Right. As a matter of fact, his son plays on what is that sport in England? Where, not baseball, but...
cricket?
His son plays on the same cricket team as Richard. And this afternoon, Richard said, when we play in this little village, he is likely to be there. His father was likely to be there. And indeed, we went to this village, and there he was, seated outside. By he, I mean Professor Salter, was seated outside with his son, drinking a cup of tea prior to the game. And I went up to him. I was very trepidatious, and I introduced myself, and I said, you know, I was a student of yours back in the 1950s, and I wanted to tell you how much of an influence you were on me. I was a grown man, but nonetheless, I felt very nervous about addressing him. And he said, well, fine, let us get together after the game, after the match, whatever they call it. So there was the long cricket match. Then we repaired to the local pub, and we were very somewhat awkward, and he bought me a pint, and then I bought him a pint, and things loosened up a little bit. And then one thing led to another, and we spent the whole night just drinking, but we were very polite. Nothing untoward was said or done, but nonetheless, it was a marvelous experience where we just interviewed with each other. And that was one of the highlights of my memory about Exeter University after the fact.
And he taught what?
He taught British drama.
British drama.
Yeah, and the modern British. Basically, he specialized in British drama, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So,
it's quite a rich year.
It was, yes. I came back on the Ile-de-France. I came back in a tourist class, but I had picked up some social skills at the time, and I knew that if I put on a suit and tie, I could go into first class and nobody would say anything. So I spent most of my time at night in the first class bar on the Ile-de-France. And since we're talking about all kinds of things, on board the Ile-de-France that time was Errol Flynn in first class with his young mistress or whatever his lover, whatever you want to call her. She was, I think, in her young 20s. He was an ancient Hollywood star at the time, very ancient, somewhat diminished because of his excesses. But anyway, he was there with his young woman and a couple of other friends. And there I was at the bar. I don't know, I'm making this up either. But she was being ignored, I noticed, because Errol Flynn was talking to these guys and she was just seated there, doing nothing, looking terribly bored. So there was live music being played in the first class lounge. So I walked all the way across the dance floor. I went up to her and asked her if she would dance. She said no. I, of course, being thoroughly humiliated, I turned around, walked back to the bar where I sat. But anyway, I always like to tell this story because that was the first and only time. Well, the thought of asking Errol Flynn's mistress to dance showed that I have progressed socially to a certain extent over time.
It is a wonderful story. When someone's doing her oral history, she is probably telling the same story that she missed the chance to dance with you.
I doubt it, but anyway, I forget her name. I wish I could know it, but I don't know it.
So. And the Ile-de-France must have been a pretty wonderful ship.
It was a marvelous ship, yes, right. It was an older ship. It had seen better days, but it was very elegant. And this was the end of an era of transatlantic travel. I mean, it was rapidly coming to a close at the time because the Boeing 707 had been developed and it was rapidly taking away the trade from the transatlantic shipping. It was too bad because it was a very elegant way to travel. Great food and just a very luxurious and comfortable way to travel. And I'm glad that I had an opportunity to do that.
So you come back to New York and you go back to...
Yes, I was happy to get back home. Being away for 9 months was...
This is tape 2, side 1 of the November 28th, 2005 oral history interview with Emeritus Professor Tino Baglio, Emeritus in Communication Arts and film historian.
So you're back.
Well, it was a very sobering experience coming back to Hammond, Indiana, after having spent 9 months in Europe, leading the good life, and then waking up one morning, having to go to the Hammond Sanitary District and cut grass. But that brought me back down to terra firma again, because I had to save money to go to finish up my college at Wabash. So. The following year progressed uneventfully. I excelled academically by then because I had lots of experiences and lots of exposure, and I was able to perform very well in my classes and so forth. But you might say because I had lots of catching up to do academically, I did not graduate Phi Beta Kappa or anything like that. I graduated, you know, I had a respectable undergraduate GPA, and by the time I graduated from Wabash, I was, I think, quite a proficient student. But nonetheless, I had catching up to do, and my catching up would continue. I mean, I had not reached by any means any real point of academic perfection. There were things that I had to perfect later on in my academic career.
Tino, did you have to write a major paper as an undergraduate?
No, I didn't. I wrote term papers and, you know, essays and things like that, but I did not get a firm grounding in composition or writing skills, and it took me a long time to overcome that.
Did you know as a senior in college that you were headed for a career in academia?
Well, in a way I was gravitating towards that direction because, as I pointed out to you earlier, I was sort of a snob at the time, as I thought I was, because I would go to the opera, you know, read all those heavy-duty British novels, modern novels. I was sort of a literary snob of a youthful sort back then. And I didn't really necessarily think of going into academia because I didn't know what academia was all about.
Uh-huh.
But I did know when I graduated from Wabash that I wanted to learn more about English literature because I had enjoyed it so much as an undergraduate. And I applied to go to Indiana University. That was my only application. Again, I did not do any pre-planning. I was accepted in the English department at Indiana University, and I resumed my academic career there, pursuing a master's degree in English literature. But I discovered that English literature at the graduate level was quite different from English literature on the undergraduate level. Because at the undergraduate level, you talked about the substance of the novel, talked about its meaning, how you responded to it emotionally, and it was a living work of art that you were dealing with. In graduate school, it's quite different because the emphasis was placed upon literary history, professional problems of understanding, you know, the work, the theory of narrative construction, and things like this, and other things. And this came as a disappointment to me, because I wanted to learn more about life through literature. And as I said, graduate school in English literature came as a surprise to me. It was somewhat of a disappointment. I got my master's degree, and I was...
In what year, Tino?
In 1961.
So you were a graduate student for 2 years.
Yes, yes, right. I knew that I was not going to go on for my PhD in English literature at this time. I wasn't interested in English literature as an academic profession as a result of my experiences there.
What was your master's thesis on?
I did a bibliographic essay on the reception of Charles Dickens's Little Dorrit.
Oh.
You know, so, but I went over to the speech and drama department. The chair of the department was a Wabash graduate, and I chatted with him. And he encouraged me to apply to the theater program there, which had interested me because of, again, it was an art form, a live art form, and I thought that I might be interested, and I enrolled, and I was accepted, and I really excelled. I was, many respects, a local, I hate to characterize it as a local star, but nonetheless, that was when I really began to grow as an academic, and I enjoyed the experience immensely.
What does that mean exactly, that you started to grow and excel?
Because, first of all, the training I received required creativity, and it required, you know, intellectual skills. For example, I took courses in costume design, stage design, lighting design, and those courses tapped my creativity. I designed costumes. I even made costumes. In the scene shop, I constructed things. I designed stage sets. I mean, they were not great, but nonetheless, no, I mean, they would never take any awards, but I felt like there's a side of me that I didn't realize existed was being tapped, my creative side. And ultimately, I became a director. But my training in English literature served me well in the program because I had sufficient literary skills to excel in courses in dramatic literature. And by then I had perfected my writing to the point that I was asked to write a dissertation on a subject that we can discuss in a moment, but I did very well throughout and enjoyed the experience because it tapped all sides of me, in my creative side and my so-called intellectual side. More than anything else, it was physically demanding as well. You're in the scene shop, you work with your hands, you put up sets, and all this is all part of an aesthetic, artistic, intellectual experience. And for the first time in my life, I had experienced that, and I enjoyed it immensely.
Were you doing any performing?
No, I never acted. I never acted, and I'm sorry that I did not. As a matter of fact, my inability to understand the acting craft was an inhibiting factor for me as a director, because when I took my first job, so I was directing plays, but I was unable to communicate the necessary skills or the information to actors to bring out in them what I wanted to have brought out. But that happened later. In graduate school, I got my PhD in 3 years. I finished my coursework in 2 years, and I had finished my dissertation in about 6 months.
And what was your dissertation?
It was the history of the National Theater Conference. The National Theater Conference was an organization consisting of academics and the heads of non-professional theater organizations in the United States. This organization was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation during the 40s and 50s. And it was the first attempt on the part of the Rockefeller Foundation to raise artistic standards in the theater outside of Broadway, so to speak. And I wrote the papers of the National Theater Conference were located in the Lilly Library on campus because a previous president of the organization arranged for the papers to be deposited there. And the organization asked me if I would be willing to write a history of it, which I said, of course. And the papers were there, and I got the cooperation of the organization. And as a result of being writing the history, they arranged for its publication and even made me a member. Normally, you would have to wait until you're in the twilight years of your academic career before you become a member of this. This is sort of an honorary organization of leaders, of academic leaders in the theater back then, but they made me a member just because they enjoyed, they appreciated the fact that I had written this this history. And this was a big boon to me as a young, aspiring academic.
Yeah, and that's going to be helpful, I'm sure, in your subsequent career as a film historian.
Mm-hmm.
Tino, now you mentioned earlier in this interview, as a senior back at Wabash, you encountered film as an art form for the first time.
Yes, right.
Are you pursuing that interest now, too?
No, because film had not become a part of the university curriculum. Film was not really a part of the university curriculum until the 60s, until the late 60s, at least outside of New York. There was no such thing as a film course. There were no such thing in Indiana as film societies at this time. At Indiana, as a graduate student, I did go to an art theater, and I remember seeing the Ingmar Bergman films that were coming out, and many of the fine foreign films that were coming out during this time. We're talking now about the early 1960s. So this was the period when I began to be exposed to foreign films, but not in any sort of systematic way. I became interested in foreign films just basically as a cinephile, you might say. But I was also interested in the James Bond films that were coming out at the same time and everything. So you might say that at Indiana University, my consciousness was being raised by foreign films, but there were no courses in the subject. Even if you wanted to study it, there'd be no way to really do it, because very little literature was written about film history then. Films were not easily accessible. Mm-hmm. If they were not playing in the local theater, there's no way to see a film. It was just not part of the academic landscape at that time, at least at Indiana University.
So you got your PhD in theater and drama?
Yes.
In 1964?
Yes. And I went to Oberlin College to teach. This was a job to replace a professor who was on leave. And the chair of the department at at Indiana University had previously taught at Oberlin and put in a good word for me, and I was hired as its replacement for this Professor Ron Lee.
Tino, during your time of working on a PhD, you must have made the decision then that you were going to go on to be a professor?
Oh yes, absolutely, no question about it, yes. I had received lots of experience in Indiana because I was, for a couple of summers, I was the company manager of the Brown County Playhouse, which was located about 30 miles or so away from Bloomington. And every summer, the theater department there put on a summer theater program. And as I said, I was the company manager. I drove the cast to the theater, took the tickets, did the accounting and stuff like this. So I got some experience doing administrative work, overseeing theater operations at this point as well. And before I left Indiana University, I directed only one play. It was a one-act play with two characters in it. So it came off fairly well. And to show, you know, how, you might say, dumb youth is, I accepted this job at Oberlin knowing that I would have to direct three major plays in my first year. But you never, you know, when you're young, you never look back and say, okay, fine, I'll direct three plays. And somehow or another, I did. And they were difficult plays. The first play I directed was a George Bernard Shaw play, Heartbreak House, which if I knew anything about how complex it was, I would never have done it. But at Oberlin, they had an amateur theater organization called the Oberlin Dramatic Association. This was an extracurricular type of activity. The students ran it, and I, as a member of the speech department, was the director of the plays that the Oberlin Dramatic Association put on. But plays were taken very seriously at Oberlin, and they were heavily attended by the faculty. And if you didn't do a good job or chose the wrong play, it'd be hell to pay. But
that would affect your career.
Yeah, sure. So I had to learn fast, and my first effort was passable. People didn't complain about it, but I directed Frederick Durnmott's *The Visit*, and *She Stoops to Conquer*,
oh my,
*Camino Real*, a couple of other plays during this time, and I also became the manager of the summer theater there. They had started the summer theater program there at Oberlin, which was almost defunct, but I took it over and ran it for a couple of summers. It did okay. So I was getting into the administrative side, the business side, as well as the artistic side of theater at the time.
Tino, and what were you teaching at Oberlin?
Yes, I had to teach a course in the oral interpretation of literature. I never had a course in oral interpretation of literature. I didn't know what it was, but I said, okay, I'll try teaching it. And somehow or another, I did. But I also taught courses in theater history.
Oh.
I taught a course in speech, public speaking. And I forget what else. But basically, the courses in theater that I taught were theater history courses.
And were you happy at Oberlin?
Sure. I was newly married, and the second year we were there, we had our son, our first child. I knew that it was only going to be a temporary job to begin with.
Oh.
Because the first year was only for a one-year appointment. Then they extended it for 1 year because the guy who was on leave decided that he wasn't going to return. So then they started to do a new search for a permanent appointment or a tenure track appointment. And the speech department at Oberlin was undergoing a period of transition. The college wanted to reinterpret wanted to restructure the department. I was not in the cards to be a part of this, which is very good. I'm glad that this happened because it was very easy to get a job having taught at Oberlin College at the time.
Yeah, because it was such a fine school.
Yes, and also this was the period when higher education was expanding dramatically during the 1960s. And it was a boom period in higher education.
So during your second year at Oberlin, you must have started looking.
Yes, I did, yes. Mm-hmm. And I was offered several jobs, but from Syracuse University and LSU and others. LSU wanted to hire me sight unseen, but I took the job at Wisconsin.
Had you targeted Wisconsin
team? No.
Or was it just one of several?
Well, you know, it's difficult to target a school because you don't know what's going to become available at any given point in time. But once Wisconsin became available, I was interested. Another reason I was interested in Wisconsin was that a colleague of mine in graduate school, Ed Amore, had accepted a job at Wisconsin, and I knew him, and he enjoyed his experience here, so that got me interested.
He was in theater, wasn't he?
That's right, that's right. Yes.
And so did you come here in theater?
Yes. I joined the Department of Speech when I came to the University of Wisconsin. The Department of Speech, which is now called Communication Arts, was an umbrella department, much more so than it is now. Back then, the Department of Speech included theater and drama, it included rhetoric, it included speech disorders, that broke off, and also communications. Also radio, television, and film. So it was an umbrella department. After I came to Madison, the department splintered off. Speech disorders formed its own department almost as soon as I got here. Then theater and drama broke off in the early 1970s to form its own department. But when I came here, as I said, there was this Department of Speech that was an umbrella department.
And when you were looking, was the Department of Speech at the UW-Madison considered an excellent department?
Yes, absolutely. It was considered one of the better schools in the country. Wisconsin, though, was never part of the academic mainstream as far as theater was concerned. It had its own separate traditions here that were not necessarily a part of the national academic theater scene. It's hard to describe, primarily because the theater program at Wisconsin was closely allied to the Union Theater. And the theater program that was being produced here, even though it was being produced by the faculty, was still a part of the Wisconsin Union artistic scene, let's say.
Okay, let me, I'll pause it.